know your dope fiend. Your life may depend on it. You will not be able to see his eyes because of T-shades, but his knuckles will be white from inner tension, and his pants will be crusted with semen from constantly jacking off when he can't find a rape victim. He will stagger and babble when questioned.
We were somewhere around Barstow, on the edge of the desert, when the drugs began to take hold.
Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished up watching Terry Gilliam's 1998 film, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
A classic that everybody has probably seen.
Yes. Yeah, this is one of probably the more popular films in the collection, I would say, in terms of, like, mainstream and kind of cult appeal.
Mm.
It's kind of up there with, like, you know, The Rock, Armageddon, Spinal Tap, Robocop, those kind of ones. The ones that have seeped into, you know, just everyday culture, I guess.
Yeah. I think it might be a good idea to do the synopsis.
Yeah.
But I think we should talk about Hunter first, even, just okay, to kind of inform the story of Fear and Loathing a bit more as we talk about it.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. And then, yeah, and then shift into the film itself.
Yeah.
Do you want to do synopsis on this one, or?
Okay, I can give it a shot. The film follows Hunter S. Thompson, the journalist, and his attorney as they go to Las Vegas to cover a motor rally race in the desert, and also a narcotics conviction for police officers, and they, in so doing, get totally fucked on drugs and explore the subculture of Las Vegas.
Yeah, and I guess kind of lament the death of the 60s idealism.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, the butchered nature of the American dream.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a pretty simple and straightforward story. But before we get into the film itself, like, yeah, I think it's a good idea to jump into a little bit about Hunter himself. So, have you read much Thompson?
No.
No.
So the only way that I've ever been familiar with him is through this film and through Gonzo, the documentary.
Okay, yeah, so the Alex Gibney documentary from about 10 years ago or so. Yeah.
So I haven't actually read any of his books, okay, although people keep telling me to read his books.
Yeah, yeah, they're pretty good.
So you've read
pretty much all of them.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, I've read, I mean, where he kind of got his start, like, he was, you know, obviously a really talented writer, and what he did was his first book is called Hell's Angels, where he basically spent a year and ingratiated himself into the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang, lived with them and rode with them for a year, and then wrote about his experiences. And that kind of propelled him to kind of superstar cult figure in terms of journalism. And then he was doing the journalism where he's a participant in, he's not just an outside observer, he was actually getting involved. And then as he kind of developed and with his later style of developing the Fear and Loathing stuff, he invented Gonzo journalism, which is shifting from being a participant to actually shifting the narrative of what you're supposed to be reporting on to be actually a story about yourself.
Okay, so the Hell's Angels one is not Gonzo?
No.
But it's like the pre...
It's kind of proto...
The prologue to that.
Yes, it's not... He hasn't gone full Gonzo at that point, but he is... It's definitely his unique voice and writing style, but it's not, yeah.
The journalist himself or herself becomes really
the story versus the actual subject they're supposed to be reporting on, and doesn't have the kind of surrealistic elements and stuff that he would later infuse into his work.
Mm.
Yeah, but so I mean, he started with Hell's Angels, then there was Fear and Loathing on the Camp. He basically got hired by Rolling Stone to become a journalist for them, and that's where that kind of style developed. And, you know, covering the 1972 Democratic Convention and things like, which is Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail, and then, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and then just, developed and was one of their top journalists in the 70s.
Mm. So I think, like, the main aspect of his work is he's trying to figure out what's happening to America constantly.
Yes.
And I think he's clearly drawn to subcultures, because he is, like, he's just, you know, thrives off it, basically.
Yeah, it seems like it's the idea. He thrives off the idea of free spirit, individuality, and people trying to discover themselves or a different way of life while still being in America. Like, you know, which I guess he describes as the American dream, like, you know, land, liberty, and, you know, being able to do.
Well, I mean, I feel like it's a rejection of the basic mainstream societal values.
Because
remember, like, in Gonzo, it talks about him running for the sheriff of...
Sheriff of Aspen.
Of Aspen.
Yes.
And he's talking about, you know, making not only drugs legal, but also you don't have to pay for the good ones. You know what I mean? And it's also like, let's make that city called Fat City. So that, you know, no one can make money off the term Aspen because they're all capitalist pigs kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's the idea of, like, he just hated the idea of establishment and the idea of America being ruled by capitalist society and things like that. Like, just authoritarian and capitalist, I guess. Which is why, like, a lot of his, you know, stuff is very anti-Nixon and things. Like, he viewed him as the devil. Because it's just poisoning this beautiful idea that America was founded on. It's been corrupted and destroyed. So, and that's why I think he threw himself so heavily into, you know, as you described it perfectly, these little subcultures, whether it be Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club or the free love movement of the 60s with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and all of those people, and surrounded himself with interesting cats like Dr. Oscar Acosta, who is portrayed in the film as Dr. Gonzo, like these weird wild cats. Just he uses them as a way to, I guess he views them as the embodiment of people trying to do that search, similar to what he's doing, of trying to discover and rekindle what is the American dream.
Yeah, I kind of connect with it. Like, I really enjoy anybody that's, you know, if you're going to
carving their own path. Or...
yeah, if you're going to go crazy, try and explore, like, what it means to be alive and stuff, even if you're going to the extent of doing that many drugs.
Yep.
Which is probably maybe too destructive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still kind of commendable in a way, because they are really trying to get to the bottom of something there. So.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this film is trying to show.
Mm.
Like, it definitely paints him as a kind of hero, or I guess the anti-hero.
Yeah.
And it seems like all of the kind of square people or straight people, they're kind of freaks in their own way, in terms of Hunter is viewing them as freaks.
Yeah.
Because they're just too straight and they're not exploring. Mm.
And they're just
to like a level that he would think is satisfactory.
And they're just accepting life as it is, kind of, as, you know, it's being governed and presented to them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that's what I want to explore here is, give you enough of a portrayal of Hunter to the,
I kind of get what you're going for there, but what makes the story of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and, I mean, obviously the film adaptation that we're going to be talking about, what separates that is it's not actually Hunter as the protagonist. It's kind of his alter ego character of Raoul Duke. So it is... It kind of draws that... There's the line drawn in the sand of, like, what is real and what is fiction, what is actually... what did happen, what, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So it isn't... You can't necessarily use Fear and Loathing, the text, as an exploration of Hunter himself. You can, but, like, not to the extent of dissecting the actions of Duke as a character as explicitly Hunter, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, because I'd say there's sequences in the film where he's riding.
Yes.
Then that's where you're getting Hunter, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in particular, the wave speech.
Yeah,
which is just beautiful.
But then every other time, like, and that's like such a small percentage of the film. Every other time he's mashed and just like kind of having a good time.
Yeah.
And it's Hunter, but it's like a
twisted caricature version of him, like... you see in the Ralph Steadman drawings and things, it's this, like, hunched-over monster kind of guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's primarily what I think Johnny Depp is doing in the film, and, like, what you know, Raoul Duke. Like, there's nods and references to Thompson. Like, they keep saying, like, you know, we got a... the booking's under Thompson, and, you know, we got a telegram from Thompson, and blah, 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 all of that stuff. So there's these little allusions to it being him, but it still maintains the whole identity of Raoul Duke. This is a caricature of...
So is... Can I... I just want to kind of make clear so that I know who exactly Raoul Duke is. Is he Hunter's alter ego as a drug user? Like, when he is a drug user, he's...
No, he's just an alter ego plugged into this narrative.
Okay.
Really? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
It's been a while since I've sat down and read a bunch of Thompson, actually. Like, quite a while. But, yeah, I'm not too sure why...
So if he's going to make a... So is it like he's going to make a story about traveling through Vegas, and if he's going to be the journalist in the story, he's just going to give himself the name.
Yeah. Roger. Well, I mean, like, this one boils down to, this is one of two books by Thompson that are classified, like, if you go to a bookstore or you go to a library to get them, it's in the fiction section. It's not a non-fiction journalistic account of a debaucherous weekend in Vegas. It's classified as fiction. So, and I think by doing that and injecting, shifting the persona and the character to Duke, that does kind of, it turns it into one of the great modern American novels versus just a really fucking weird piece of telling of a fucked up weekend. Yeah. That's my, like, you know, dissection of it, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm. But yeah, I mean, if anyone hasn't read the book, it's a real easy read, and it's really good.
Like, it's really short, apparently, as well, right?
Yeah, it's only about 200 pages or so. Like, that's what I was meaning, like a nice easy read.
Yeah.
And you do get these wonderful... There's certain chapters and pages that you're just like, oh, I understand why Thompson was so revered as a writer. Like, he is an amazing wordsmith. Like, I mean, the one I mentioned just before, like, the wave speech, talking about the crumbling of the ideas and everything that were established in with free love and the hippie movement of the 60s, and how that died, and, you know, I think it ends with, you know, with the right set of eyes, you can go up to a hill just south of Las Vegas, and you can see the high water mark where, you know, our dreams and ideals, like, the wave hit, and then just rolled back. Like, we didn't ever crest that pinnacle. It's wonderful writing.
Yeah, fuck yeah. And what amazes me I guess, like, a lot of the narration in the film, is that lifted basically wholesale out of the book?
This is one of the most faithful adaptations of book to screen I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
Like, it is almost word for word. Right. The movie. Yeah,
because when I was watching it, I was thinking, I was like, who's writing this? Like, this is, like, surely... It's got to be lifted out of the book, basically.
Yeah, it's all taken completely from the book, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Mm. But, I mean, should we shift on to the film itself at this point and break that one down? Because while it's, you know, I mean, I'm a big fan of it. I've seen it a ridiculous amount of times. I want to say this is probably my second or third Criterion I ever owned. But I think why I connected so strongly with it was... Like, A, because it being such a faithful adaptation of Thompson's work, and then it is such a, like, a prime example of Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
Like, it is Terry Gilliam through and through.
Yeah, it's just a carnival.
Yeah, and the way it's shot, and the visceral nature of it all, and the design and everything behind it is just... Gilliam.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's interesting to me is I've read that Gilliam has never touched a drug in his life, beyond, I suppose, booze.
Yes.
So how... Because when you're watching this, because it's got the Dutch angles that are constantly moving around, and it's got all of the smoke that's kind of, like, creating this filter across everything, there's these... Like, it's always pink neons and yellows and orange colours... and mirrors everywhere. Like, you really get discombobulated when you're watching the film.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, who's ultimately responsible for making this film feel like you're going through like a trip yourself.
I would say Gillian. Like, it is
cinematographers as well, because
yeah, I mean, it's his first time working with a cinematographer, Nicola Pecorini, who's kind of become his go-to cinematographer since this film onwards. Mm. Yeah, the two of them have a really nice kind of working relationship, and he's dialed into that Gillian visual style. But you're mentioning, like, the Dutch angles and the interesting use of colour and everything. That's something that's kind of been with Gilliam's work since Brazil, I would say.
True.
Like, early on with, like, you know, Holy Grail and Time Bandits and things, it's not so much there. But with Brazil, he really started going for it in terms of his visuals and kind of the shot choices he would use.
A lot of, like, extreme close-ups?
Extreme close-ups, almost with, like, a very wide angle lens, so it kind of really distorts the view of
it's almost like a fisheye lens or something.
Yeah, and the incredible use of Dutch angles and bizarre kind of composition, the way to some of the scenes where, like, it's a Dutch angle of... There was one in particular when Duke and Dr. Gonzo were in the car driving up and down the strip on the Saturday night, and it's a low angle Dutch inside the car, but the way it's framed makes it look like they're sitting perfectly straight normally, but with the weird Dutch neon, like the angled lights going behind them, and they're both in the frame. It's like really interesting compositions.
Mm. Yeah, everything's just distorted like fire. Yeah. But I was trying to think about, like, you know, how is he producing a feeling in me that makes me feel like I am tripping?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to, like, start making that list of the mirrors and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the compositions is a really interesting one. There's never any flat shots.
No.
Except we noticed in the narcotics conference.
Yes.
When you finally get, like, just, like, heaps and heaps of straight cops everywhere. Then you finally get a couple of just flat shots that are just like an
whenever they're not, it's only whenever they're not in their hotel room.
Mm.
Every other time, it's the color as well is really drained out of it. Like when they're checking in, it's very white and plain, and kind of you've got the blown out lights of the, you know, outside world kind of blaring in, and then of course the conference itself where they're sitting down watching Michael Jeter do his speech and things, and it's like this horrible washed out blue.
There was a sick shot at the start of that scene. They're inside the car and they open up and everything's got this orange tinge to it. And then they open up the convertible's top and then the camera pulls out and the tinge bleeds away to just everything stark and white.
Yeah.
And they just rock up to the cop station. That's, you know, they start this new kind of color tone throughout that scene.
Yeah. And that's also like the shift of the book and the film, like, it's shifting from into the two distinct parts of fear, and then it's shifted into the loathing part, which is, yeah.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
Mm. Where would this sit for you in terms of a Gilliam film? Like,
oh, well, my favourite is Brazil.
Yes.
Definitely. Yeah, maybe this is my second favourite.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I've watched it a shit ton of times. I had, like, a phase when I was 16 or something, where I just watch it again and again and again.
Yeah, that's something I kind of want to discuss as well. But, that's interesting that, yeah, because it is... I think because the story is for, like... It's not a simple story. It's dealing with some really interesting themes, and there's some really hefty language at play there. But it's... at its essence, it's two guys having a bender. And so that allows Gilliam, it frees Gilliam up to not necessarily focus heavily on a thematic story or characters or anything like that, and it lets him just play visually, and that's why I think it's so powerful and unique, like, so uniquely a Gilliam film.
It does have a sense of, like, this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens.
Yeah.
There's no real arc.
No.
I mean, there's even, like, one of my favourite sequences in it is when he wakes up with the lizard's tail on, and he's got the gum boots. And it's just him after, like, this massive fucked up bender that may have lasted for 2 nights and 2 days. And there's just, like, these flashbacks, but you start to
pressing play on the tape recorder and listening back.
And the way the editing works is you're actually not really... At a certain point, you're actually questioning whether, you know, he woke up in a dream and like, this is... Like, this new scene that maybe a flashback is now actually the reality.
Mm.
And so the whole film could be probably re-edited to kind of... kind of put anything anywhere and it would still just be, it still work, because you know that it's like a fucking bender.
Yeah, well, it kind of, the film itself fucks with the idea of time and space, similar to how drugs kind of fuck with your reasonings of time and space and things. So, yeah, he does it so effectively. Yeah, I can't believe he's never taken a drug, given his, like, art styles and everything, and just, yeah, and so effectively being able to portray being on drugs in a movie. So.
Especially acid.
Yeah, he nails that.
yeah, there's, like, that sequence with the lizards.
Mm.
You never see lizards, but in real life when you do acid. But I loved the carpet. Like, it's super rare to find films that actually, like, a lot of films just go too far.
Yeah.
There's also Taking Woodstock.
Yes.
Where there's that scene in
where
the
tent. Where they're in the van. Yeah.
The van, yeah. And I feel like that, they've done drugs for sure. They know exactly how acid works. And they're like, we'll recreate that.
I would love to see Ang Lee tripping. That would be pretty amazing.
But the moving carpet thing, like everything's breathing and stuff. And the facial features getting distorted like that.
The kind of fluidity to everything, yeah.
Yeah, it just amazes me, like, how much they nailed it without going overboard. And then you get the lizards where it's, like, I even enjoy that kind of sequence where it's, like, you would never actually see that, but you can definitely feel it sometimes.
I think it's as well, like, it's the way you can perceive it in the as it's written in the text is, they're not actually lizards. He's using it as a metaphor for these, like, gross hedonistic things, and then, you know, and someone's giving booze to these goddamn things.
Yeah.
But then it's complemented with Ralph Steadman taking that interesting kind of metaphor that Hunter's established, and then he makes it a reality by actually drawing hedonistic lizards writhing around in, like, filth. And then that's because of that, Gilliam is then taking the sparse uses of the visual drawings and interpreting, and it's great.
I fucking love Steadman.
Yeah.
He is, like, one of my favorite artists, for sure.
Yeah, again, like, such a wonderful, unique style that matches so perfectly with Thompson, and, yeah. Match made in heaven, those two.
Yeah. Yeah, I just love the idea of people kicking about and just making fun of normality.
Yeah.
Trying to push away from it.
But I want to talk a little bit about the performances. It's really easy to see, rewatching this, why Johnny Depp has gone on to become, the voice of Thompson now and forever. Like, in terms of whenever there's a documentary or anything done, they always get him to do the narration or the readings and things. It's so... He delivered the perfect embodiment of Thompson. But to the that being said, he is doing the overblown caricature of him, but he just nails it.
yeah, I mean, look how much he's fallen since this role, but I actually thought that I kind of give more props to Del Toro.
Me too.
You know, like, I mean, yeah, Depp is fucking amazing.
Yeah, no, I was just talking about Johnny for a little bit so then I could move on to Del Toro, yes.
No, of course, Depp does an amazing job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, even in the Gonzo documentary, they get him to do
the narration. Yeah, he's the narrator for it, yeah.
But you forget how awesome Del Toro is. And I think when I was a kid, I was connecting with Hunter.
Yes. More. Well, he is the protagonist of the film. Yeah. And it's as well, like, Dr. Gonzo is a reprehensible monster of a man in the way he's presented in this.
Yeah, he's villainous.
Yeah.
The pie sequence in Vegas.
The Night Stud Cafe is just, it's
horrific.
Brutal, yeah.
But I mean, like, that's what makes it brutal, is he's just fucking frightening, man.
Mm.
And, yeah, props to that guy, dude, like, Jesus.
Yeah, watching it again, like, you forget how far Del Toro goes with the role. He gained 40 pounds as well, like, he put on a shitload of weight to accurately do it, and yeah, just
some of those belly shots.
Oh, so gross. When he's, like, pouring the beer and the suntan lotion and this oily mess. But he so perfectly shifts. They're the kind of, the characters have their counter moments where there are the scenes where one of them will be going apeshit and the other one acts as a kind of lightning rod of normality, I guess, to try and help calm them or bring them back down.
Or communicate with others.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Del Toro does it way better than Depp does. Like, when Depp is supposed to be that calming kind of, for lack of a better term, sober one, he's still manic and very kinetic and yelly and, you know, aggravated about what's happening. Whereas when Del Toro does it, he's very calm. And, like, when they get into the hotel room after checking, he's like, what were you talking about, mate? Like, just tries to very calmly talk him through stuff. And likewise, when he's taking the adrenochrome. But then he so magically shifts to an absolute demon.
Yeah.
Like, the bathtub scene is just next level.
did Depp get nominated?
No.
No one did.
Yeah, that's just... Oh, no, they did, actually. They both got nominated for Razzies.
What?
Yeah. No, not Razzies. Like, the other knockoff Razzie, I think. I'm double-checking this now. Yeah, which is insanity, really.
What the fuck?
Where is it?
Man, they...
Yeah, they are worst on-screen couple and worst supporting actor for Del Toro for the Stinker Bad Movie Awards.
Holy fuck.
Idiot. This is why I fucking hate the Razzies and awards for bad films, because you're like... Like, fuck you, just because one person didn't like it, like, you just didn't understand it or whatever, like...
You can't... I feel like, objectively, there's no way you could say that it's bad, because, like, it's... There's so much energy going on, and he really...
It's so unique and memorable, and I guess it's that thing of why some people, like, you know, it's the Nicolas Cage thing, where, like, he's just goes for it, and it could work in it, or it could not, but, like, and I will say, like, Del Toro's energy and performance could, you could be like, this is just fucked and weird, and I don't get this at all, but... It works so perfectly for what the character is and what the scenario is, and in particular the film that it's all housed in. Mm. It's a manic, bizarre, messy trip. So it's so perfect.
It's amazing.
And also, we should probably mention some of the supporting cast that pops up throughout the film. It's pretty incredible.
I think the cast list is nutty.
I mean,
there's a lot of people that went on to become super famous.
Or were already famous at this point.
Christina Ricci had done Adam's Family and stuff.
Yeah, well, this is 1998, so if you think about it, Tobey Maguire is 1 year off being cast as Spider-Man.
Huh.
Cameron Diaz is, I think, pre-production or whatever. It's like getting ready. Something About Mary is around 98, so...
Yeah.
Mm, so... You got Gary Busey as the highway cop, Harry Dean Stanton in there as a judge.
Penn Teller?
Penn Jillette.
Penn Jillette.
Of Penn and Teller.
And Teller.
Who else? Lyle Lovett, Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's insane.
And Hunter as well.
And Hunter himself, yeah.
Oh, was Flea the guy that was snorting off the red jacket?
Yeah. Who hopefully they ruin a guy's life forever. Yeah. Well, that's actually a good point to jump in. Us giggling about that scene. The film's hysterical. Yes. It is such a wonderful comedy. And I think tonally it does a good job of balancing the wacky escapades and the bizarre comedic black comedy writing of Hunter with the more actual dramatic stuff that he's trying to explore with his writing. It does that really, really well. But I think because of some of the comedic elements, the film has been... I don't want to say co-opted, but, like, embraced as a drug movie, I think, which I kind of have a bit of a problem with.
Now, when you say it's been embraced as a drug movie, are you referring to the idea that...
People are like, yeah, this movie's cool because it's about people on drugs.
Yeah, okay.
And not actually connecting with what... the writing and what it's trying to say, and it's just exploring out through the prism of drug taking and a bender, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think... Well, I read it as they're doing heaps of drugs because having watched what could have happened in the 60s burn out, it even says at some point that it's a shame that we all gotta do the drugs as well to some degree.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, how else are you gonna... Like, what else is there to do, basically?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're trying to chase that dream that never came to pass.
That's
so,
right, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think a lot of... I mean, I could be speaking out of turn here, but I've met throughout my years a whole bunch of people that like this movie just because it's about people taking a bunch of drugs and being trippy. Where it's... Where I don't view the film as that at all. I think the drugs are in there almost as a narrative device to help facilitate what the film is doing.
Mm.
And it would, yeah. I mean, you couldn't take them out of the story, but no. It's, yeah. But it is, they're not the central element and be-all, end-all of this story. And I think it's a bit of a bummer that it's kind of... Like, it's one of those movies where you see people with, like, you know, college, like, 18-year-old kids with posters up on their walls and being like, yeah, it's the drugs, man!
Yeah, that's that's what I was like, though, you know, when I was really young watching it.
Yeah.
But then, and I guess it's, like, a little bit of a naive way to look at it.
Yes.
But then, of course, like, the people that you're talking about, I think, they are, tend to be younger.
It skews younger, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, because it is...
But then you have the hope that eventually they'll... come to realize, like, oh wait, it's actually about so much more.
it's like reading Game of Thrones for the violence or something.
Yeah,
when it's like, because the political stuff and the historical elements are going over your head, but you dig the sex scenes and you dig the violence.
Yeah, that's a good analogy for it,
actually. And then later on you'll read it and be like, oh shit, actually there's like that's just the icing on the cake stuff.
Yes.
Just yeah. As like the jokes with the drugs and this is the icing on the cake. It is hilarious.
Yeah. But it's also, I don't think drugs are not portrayed in a positive way in this film even.
No.
So that's what I've always kind of found fascinating about it. It's when someone's like, yeah, let's get high and watch Fear and Loathing. I'm like, that would be terrible. Like,
I've done it.
That would make me feel gross watching it.
It's pretty fun.
Mm.
But it's intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's fine. Just, like... It's like Fight Club as well.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful example.
Yeah, Fight Club, when I was a kid, I watched that, and I even did a movie review at school, and my English teacher was like, that's a fucking stupid movie. And I was like, nah, but, you know, I mean, like, I was, it was a romantic sense of being the strong, you know, strong, muscly, confident male, like, adult or whatever. But underneath it is... like this awesome critique of
that whole idea of masculinity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot going on, but of course, like, you know, ladies will watch that because it's got a sexy Brad Pitt in it, and you know, teenage boys will watch it because it's people fighting. But yeah, it's just like this. It's not the point of it.
No.
But yeah, kids, they get drawn to it. I would like to actually talk about, I mean, we already talked about Johnny Depp as the quintessential hunter.
Yep.
But I'd like to talk about Bill Murray as well.
Okay, yeah, we should...
Because
for those who don't know, this is the second film adaptation about Thompson. The first one was done in 1980, directed by Art Linson, who weirdly went on to produce Fight Club. While we're on that note.
Okay.
And it stars Bill Murray as Hunter S. Thompson and Peter Boyle, weirdly, as Dr. Gonzo. And that's kind of more of a... even less of a linear story, and it's kind of following him through leading up to the Kentucky Derby story, which was kind of his first example of Gonzo journalism.
I think Bill Murray does a pretty good job as well.
Bill Murray plays Hunter S. Thompson brilliantly, but he's playing Hunter Thompson. He's not playing Raoul Duke.
Okay.
Which is why he has some of the mannerisms and some of the stuff, but it's a lot more reserved, I think is a good way to describe it.
Yeah. But I think the thing is if you watch that film, you can recognize Hunter in it.
Oh, yeah.
But I think what makes Fear and Loathing so much better is you're watching Johnny Depp play as Hunter, but there's so much involved in not just his acting, but the way that he's shot.
Yes.
That just, like, they just come together to make it even more like a Hunter S. Thompson trip.
Yeah.
And so it's like the sum of the parts is less than the whole.
Yeah.
But whereas, like, with Bill Murray's character, like, it's just the way that it's shot is just, like...
Oh, it's just a very subpar, like...
Yeah.
I don't mind it. I think it's actually a pretty fun film, but it's very standard in the way that it's shot and presented. It's, yeah. There's nothing really interesting or exciting about it. It's very flat and simple. So,
yeah.
So I think, is that, like, the thing to do a good adaptation of... Thompson, you need to get someone who understands and can bring a unique flair to the visuals, like Gilliam, or later on you've got Bruce Robinson doing The Rum Diary.
Yeah, I think I never saw that, so I don't know.
Mm. It's a little bit more subdued because it is... I forgot to mention, that's also a fictional novel, I think.
Yeah.
Did I mention that one earlier? Anyway. Yeah.
No, you didn't, but yes.
Mm. I'm just saving my corrections department thing. Yeah.
Yeah, what were we saying?
Getting an interesting director to kind of helm and interpret the work to add that kind of... to elevate it in terms of... and shifting it from the written form into a visual medium. You'd actually need to have someone who can bring their own style and flavour to it to kind of make it something special.
I think, like, who did Evil Dead? Was it Sam Raimi?
Yep.
Sam Raimi would be a good one as well. So there's like a lot of shared visual flair between Evil Dead and Fear and Loathing.
I'd say, I could imagine that, yeah.
Because it's all trying to be, they're all, in a sense, like it's kind of twisted horror. That's how you would approach the filmmaking.
Yeah.
Because the Gilliam's trying to do something horrific.
Yeah.
But obviously Evil Dead's like proper horror, I guess, but...
On that note, I'd fucking love to see Terry Gilliam do a horror movie. I'd never thought about that. That would be awesome.
That would be awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
Like a comedy horror.
Yeah.
Like Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Evil Dead, yeah, exactly.
I mean, the kind of closest he ever came was probably 12 Monkeys. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's not wacky horror. That's not wacky comedy.
No, like, it's not like comedy at all, but it's got some, you know, it's very weird dystopian sci-fi stuff. So, I was just trying to think of something that's closest to horror. That he's done. I mean, there's some mild horror-y kind of stuff in Brothers Grimm, but that's... Yeah.
I've forgotten about that movie.
Yeah.
I feel like Gilliam's later works are kind of hit and miss for me.
I wouldn't say that. I think it's the problem of he's not a financially successful filmmaker, so he finds that he has a lot of trouble getting the appropriate money to make his films. And Brothers Grimm, you watch it and you're like, if you were given the proper amount of money to make this film, it would be really cool and really interesting. I love Heath Ledger's performance in that. I think it's weird and unique and wonderful. And Matt Damon as well. They're both great. And it's an interesting story, but it's just looks like it was made for $2.75. Like, it's just, which is a problem when you're trying to tell, you know, a period, weird fantasy period piece.
Mm.
The same kind of goes for Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, but I mean, that was also plagued with...
yeah, problems.
Yeah, and... but then, some of his more recent stuff, like The Zero Theorem, I loved. I thought that was really fun.
I have to fucking watch that, man.
I recommend it.
Yeah, okay.
It's a weird little interesting movie. And, we get our first new Gilliam in fucking ages this year with, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, after him trying to make that for like 20 years.
Oh shit, yeah.
It's finally coming out.
So what happened with that? He tried to make it in the 90s?
Late 90s, right after Fear and Loathing, actually.
Right.
He cast Johnny Depp in the lead and French actor Jean Rochefort. They filmed for like one or two days in Spain. Jean Rochefort was very ill and couldn't really deliver his performance, and so it was like, that's not gonna work. And then a flood came through and washed all their sets and equipment away, and it just plug had to be pulled. It just got shat on the whole production after like 2 or 3 days.
Oh my god.
And then ever since then he's been trying to get it made, and it's gone through so many iterations of, like, Johnny Depp was gonna be in it, then he was replaced with Ewan McGregor was gonna be in it for a while. And now that they finally shot it, it's Adam Driver, which is super interesting and exciting.
Oh, good for him.
I love Adam Driver, the fact that he's a huge star because of Star Wars, that in between doing Star Wars, he does, like, Terry Gilliam films or Jim Jarmusch movies.
Or Scorsese films.
Yeah, he just picks, and like, and not even big Scorsese, like, he does Silence. Yeah. The one about Jesuit priests in Japan.
Yeah, he's exciting, man, like...
He picks and chooses, he, like, he clearly wants to work with specific directors and yeah. that are interesting, so...
Yeah, he's really cool.
Yeah.
We might have to re-edit because we're, like, jumping from Johnny Depp to other stuff, then back to Johnny Depp, but...
I think that's fine, because as a film, in terms of its narrative and stuff, there's not much there. It is mostly Gilliam and visuals and things, so...
I want to kind of figure out... Let's talk about, how, like, the preparation, like, what goes into preparation of the acting, because... Mm-hmm. So you're saying he stayed in Hunter's basement?
Yep.
For 4 months?
Lived with Hunter for 4 months, kind of studying him, learning his speech pattern and his physical mannerisms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blown up propane tanks.
Yep. And Hunter himself shaved Johnny Depp's head with a Bowie knife while wearing a miner's helmet. Weird shit like that. So, yeah, that was... I think they were already friends, and then, like, Hunter gave his total and utter approval of Johnny being cast to play him, and then, you know, it was just two friends hanging out for 4 months as...
Bonding over explosives.
Yeah.
I think when he died, I think Johnny Depp ended up financing the cannon, like, put the ashes in the cannon.
And he lit the fuse, yeah, that launched it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they were
really good. Going into the stratosphere.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
And yeah, Del Toro, I didn't really have much since Oscar Acosta died in the 70s, so... Yeah. Dr. Gonzo was found drowned.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. No one knows what happened.
Is there a tape recorder in the bath?
No. No, it was, like, washed up on the ocean or something, and on the beach, I believe, and so it was just kind of like, okay.
Yeah,
it's kind of one of those.
He sounds like a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, he would be the last person I'd want around.
But, when he wasn't, like, a fucking monster, he was actually, like, a really prolific civil rights lawyer.
Okay.
And, yeah, so, he did a lot of interesting stuff, but he was also just... fiend. I think is a good word for him.
Jesus.
Yeah.
What else we got?
I don't know. I think I'm almost kind of spent on this one. In terms of, yeah.
So we could do a little bit of a wrap up, I guess. We've already talked about. I mean. Do we want to go into, like, what the film is its final messages?
Yeah, that'd be a nice way to kind of sum it up. And, like, okay, how did you take it? Like?
So I rated it as, I reckon certain people connect with Hunter, and Gilliam is one, that's why I wanted to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because they all... There's, like, a rebel in most people, to what extent might differ. But you're always, like, the one that speaks out for justice.
Mm.
And even if it's in the face of authority, mm. to the extent of, say, the US government. And I think even though Hunter, and the film presents him in this way, is a kind of destructive spirit, he's also deeply caring for just people in general.
Yeah.
And so although the film is going like, yeah, well, you know, people like him do heaps of drugs, but they're also writing and trying to put something out to change people's minds. And I think that's what the film's doing. It's got a destructive element,
mm.
but it's putting an idea out there that is saying, you know, please do think about what the American dream means.
It's trying to throw out some empathy.
Yeah. And go and saying like, don't blindly follow that suburban dream of owning the house when it might just be a fucking joke.
Yeah, and or, you know, don't it's okay to question your government and your president and all of this kind of stuff. So. Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I mean, that's what it's going for, I think.
And I think the film perfectly kind of encapsulates that without bombarding the viewer with that message. It's there, but it's not like hitting you over the head with it. It's subtly there and like nice, done, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's driving at the end and just kind of doing like his like finish up narration. And it's quite poetic, but it doesn't really finish with a bang.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really peter out either, but...
No, it just kind of...
It's just leaving with a few meandering thoughts, and then you just left to...
It's kind of like, take from this wild weekend what you will. Like, hopefully the little bit of words and wisdom and things that you've been presented have impacted you, or you've taken a few little nuggets of ideas, and you can take them with you as you go.
Yeah. So what do you reckon...
Oh, you've nailed exactly what, like, my... Yeah, those are my thoughts pretty much primarily, yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah, well, it's great, like...
Mm. It's interesting that you just brought up, like, the end with him just driving back to L.A. It's, bookends. Gilliam always bookends his films. So they always begin and end with more or less the same shot, which is kind of interesting.
So give me another example. How does Brazil start?
Brazil is a bit of a... It's
is that a bad example?
Well, no, it's kind of... It opens with the dream of him flying.
Oh, yeah.
And then it ends with him flying, but then it turns out, like, it's a fucked up dream and the lobotomy went wrong.
That's right.
Which is kind of like... It's close enough to book ending.
Yeah.
12 Monkeys ends with young... Like, the little boy's eyes and things.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So it's like this nice little kind of thing you can catch throughout his work, but... Mm. But yeah, you're right, it is just like this nice little narration at the end, and, you know, I think... Yeah, you have been on this destructive voyage with them, but there is a purpose to the destruction, and there is a purpose to what's happening and what they're doing, and what Duke is doing and saying, and hopefully you can take something from it.
Mm.
Fuck the establishment, burn it down. Yeah. I don't know, do you want to hear a little bit of trivia? Sure.
Sounds good.
The film was nominated for the Palme d'Or at the 1998 Cannes Film Festival. Did not win, unfortunately. But yeah, this is actually kind of similar to Gilliam's Don Quixote movie. This itself went through a massive kind of development hell. For quite a while, both Martin Scorsese and Oliver Stone each tried to get the film off the ground, but they were both unsuccessful and moved on with other projects. During initial development hell, Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando were originally considered for the roles of Duke and Gonzo.
Was Jack Nicholson one of his Hunter's friends as well?
Yep.
I think there's like a famous story of him.
Of him for his birthday playing the audio of like animals being slaughtered.
Yeah, the spotlights and he's firing off his gun.
Yep.
And then he like puts a fresh elk heart in front of the dog.
Yeah, it's a wonderful short story called Happy Birthday, Jack Nicholson. So both Nicholson and Brando unfortunately grew too old as development went on. After them, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi were considered for the duo, but that fell apart after Belushi died. Then John Malkovich was considered for the role of Duke, but again, he grew too old. And at one point, John Cusack was almost cast, but then Hunter met Johnny Depp and was convinced that no one else could play him. So that's how that kind of happened. Animator and filmmaker Ralph Bakshi, who did Wizards and Cool World and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Fritz the Cat.
Fritz the Cat, yeah.
Yep. He tried to convince the producer, Leyland Woolsey, to let him do the movie as an animated film, done in the style of Ralph Steadman's illustrations. Yeah, that unfortunately... He was convinced that was the best possible way to tell the story, because the action and the characters are such cartoons that if you did it live action, it would be unrealistic, whereas if you presented it in a cartoon way, it would be perfect. But that never came to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Director Bruce Robinson, who did wrote and directed With Nil and I,
mm-hmm.
Was asked by Johnny Depp to write and direct the film. Robinson turned down the offer, saying that, how could you get that one on the screen? Conversely, He then later on went to adapt the Thompson novel, The Rum Diary, in 2011. So he eventually did do a Thompson adaptation, but not this one. There were some other directors that were attached. Weirdly, Lee Tamahori was attached at one point. He did Once Were Warriors, like a New Zealand filmmaker.
Oh, yeah.
And then, thank God, he didn't do it, because he is famous for directing Die Another Day, the worst James Bond film ever made.
Is that the one with the guy with the diamond face?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And the invisible car.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, then basically what happened with the production of this film was the rights were going to lapse, and the studio so desperately wanted to make it that they ended up just quickly hiring a director. And they hired Alex Cox, who directed Sid and Nancy and Repo Man, which is really good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then he basically was forced out of the project because he had massive creative differences with Hunter, which is kind of really nicely documented in a... I think the doc is called Breakfast with Hunter or something. And it's like Alex Cox wanted to do like animated sequences mixed in there. In particular, during the wave speech, there was like some really fucking stupid thing he wanted to do of having Hunter like surfing on like a sea of bones. And it's like Hunter lost his shit at him, apparently. Just being like, you do not... Like, that's my favorite bit of writing I've ever done, and you just do not understand completely. Like, you want to have me as a cartoon surfing on boat? Like, what are you talking about, you fucking idiot? So he was taken off the project, and Gilliam took over as director. Yeah, so Gilliam rewrote the entire screenplay in only a few days with his writing partner, Tony Grissoni, to kind of fit more creatively his style and his vision while staying true to Hunter's work. But unfortunately, with the screenplay, because Gilliam and Grissoni kind of adapted from the original novel, there was a nasty arbitration that ended up happening with the Writers Guild, where they deemed that the script was not different enough from Alex Cox's original and his writing partner Todd Davies' like original version, and so they weren't going to give Gilliam and Tony Grissoni credit.
Because it was basically a revision.
Yeah, but Gilliam was like, we never read their script. We just... But it's similar because it's based off a fucking source novel. That is, you know, that's what it is. And so apparently there was like a really tough, like, they took it to arbitration and things with the Writers Guild, and eventually they got a credit as well. But they basically... it's shared, so it's...
That's why there's four writers.
Four writers on them. Yeah. Yeah, to this date, both Alex Cox and Gilliam both think each other is wrong, and Alex Cox still thinks he should be the only person with a writing credit, and Gilliam's like, you go fuck yourself. it apparently got so heated that, like, at a public event, Gilliam pulled out his Writers Guild membership card and burned it.
Wow.
Because he was just like, fuck you all.
I'm
like,
sick of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I found this one interesting, actually. Hunter Thompson, like, we'd mentioned that Bill Murray had previously played Thompson in Where the Buffalo Roam. So, apparently, prior to filming, Murray called Depp because they'd just done Ed Wood together and were kind of friendly. And he gave him some advice on playing Hunter, because that kind of didn't go well for Murray. They ended up... Hunter did not appreciate the performance, and they kind of... It hurt their friendship and things.
Right.
Yeah, because if you see in old footage, Bill Murray was one of the people, like, helping Hunter run for Sheriff of Aspen and stuff, like, hanging out with him in the early 70s.
Hunter's very protective of his legacy, then.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he would. Legacy.
But apparently, yeah, Bill Murray called him Depp up and said, be careful, or you'll find yourself in 10 years from now still doing him. Make sure your next role is something drastically different. So, yeah. Which I think is probably some good advice. What else? We talked about how
Depp... So what did Depp do after that?
I don't know, I'll quickly look him up.
See how, if he took Bill Murray's advice or not.
Yeah. So this was 98, so... Oh, no. He did three movies in 1999. The one where I said, oh, no, is the very next one is The Astronaut's Wife, which is a really terrible sci-fi horror. It's really bad. It's with him and Charlize Theron.
Mm-hmm.
But then he did Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty great. And then he did an interesting movie called The Ninth Gate, which is directed by Roman Polanski. It's not a bad one. Yeah. Benicio Del Toro got fat by eating donuts.
Sounds great.
Yeah, that's some trivial stuff. Yeah. Everything else I've kind of already brought up, like, in our discussion. Like, the fact... yeah, like, most of the clothes that Johnny Depp wears throughout the film are actually Hunter's clothes that he kind of took while living with him. And the kind of cool one is the Red Shark, which is the red convertible that they're driving at the beginning of the film, was actually Hunter's own car.
Hmm.
Gave it to the production to use. So, yeah. And that's about it.
Tick of approval by Hunter.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, like, it's widely considered... Like, he, you know, being very... You mentioned he's very protective of his image and things and his legacy. He's very much approved of this version to the extent that he actually sat down and did an audio commentary for the Criterion release and things, like, saying, like, yeah, no, I like this. This was a solid...
Fuck, that'd be the biggest relief for Gilliam, I reckon.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Like, he would have made it and just been like, if I fucking... If it's not appreciated by Hunter, I fucked it.
Yeah, pretty much, like, yeah.
Hunter's inspiring, man. Like, I reckon, like, he's kind of like a... Like an angel for creatives, it seems.
He's a weird... He's a shaman, almost.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A weird, fucking, monstrous little shaman guy.
Yeah, you can, like, he's got such an amazing charisma about him, where it's just, like, you know, if you would be hanging out with him, just original shit would be happening.
Yeah. It is the problem, though, of, like, as he grew older, and, you know, the years of substance abuse and things kind of took hold, and he did, unfortunately, become less of a talented writer. Like, there were still moments of gold in his writing, but it just... It seemed to take its toll on him.
Oh, I think for a large period, I think that his daily routine was sleep in to like midday, wake up, have some cocaine, cigarette, some hard liquor, then have a bath with some bud, some more cocaine for 2 hours, then he'd have breakfast, and then some more cocaine. And then he'd have some more drinks. And then at 8 o'clock, he would write while having more cocaine and more drinks. Until he go to bed about 2 and just rinse, repeat.
Yeah. And it's a thing of... I mean, he's maybe one of those few examples of being able to work and be creative while fucked up. Like, but that's not normally the case. But yeah, he... It is just, I think... The combination of that amount of booze and drugs and stuff just taking a hold and, like, you know, fucking you up. If you do that for 40 years, you'll mess yourself up.
Yeah. But he also, I think, got quite a, kind of, like, really...
He got tired.
Really disenfranchised.
Yeah, that was it. And he just lost the spark.
Yeah.
Because he'd been fighting for the same thing for, 40 years or whatever, and it just never... It was just the same shit over and over and over again. So,
but he, I mean, like, he did this shit. Like, do you know that story about him? There was like this lady in the like 90s or some shit who was accused of killing a policeman with a gun. But the fact was that someone else had fired, and she was handcuffed in the back of the car, of the cop car. And he found out about the story, and she was sentenced to life in prison, and he spent 7 years of his life, towards the end of his life, trying to get her out of that sentence.
Yeah.
And he was enlisting, like, his actor friends and stuff.
Mm.
So Del Toro was helping her out as well.
So he's still fighting for injustice and everything throughout the years.
He's still doing it, yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, she got appealed. She had an appeal, and she got out of it.
Mm.
But he'd killed himself 2 months before.
Yeah.
So that sucks.
Because it was 2005. He killed himself, I think. So yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So you know, I wish he was around still.
It would be interesting,
especially for covering Trump.
Yeah. No. See, I'm. Yes and no at the same time. Like, it's just. Fuck it. Like, fuck Trump and all that. It's just... And it's... He'd already been through all of that with Bush, and it was just... His writing and everything, it ended up just kind of... it just kind of broke him, and he's just like, we had kind of given up at that point, which is why, you know, 2005.
Mm.
He's just like, what's the point? Fuck it. So, I mean, it would be interesting, but also, like, he'd done it. He'd said all he needed to say with previous corrupt administrations, so what more can he say without repeating himself and reiterating?
Yeah, I guess that's why he's frustrated, because it was always this cycle of bullshit.
Pretty much.
But I still need people like that.
Oh, yeah. They're still out there, but it's just, yeah, unfortunately. he was a trailblazer.
Yeah,
in terms of, you know, activism and, you know, fighting and, you know... God, he pioneered an entire... He created his own style of literature. Like, he invented a new form of writing. Like, it's not often that that happens. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Wonderful man. But yeah. I guess, unless we got anything else, that might all wrap us up for Fear and Loathing.
I think that's it.
The best possible adaptation you could do of Hunter's work, I reckon. So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. It's still in print from Criterion as a 2-disc DVD or a 1-disc Blu-ray. And it comes with the special features of 3 audio commentaries. One with director Terry Gilliam, actors Johnny Depp and Benicio Del Toro, and producer Leila Nabulsi and Hunter S. Thompson. Deleted scenes with commentary by Gilliam, a collection of storyboard and production designs, still gallery, a selection of Thompson's correspondence read on camera by Johnny Depp, Hunter Goes to Hollywood, a short documentary video by filmmaker Wayne Ewing, a look at the controversy around the screenwriting credit, original trailers, TV spots, rare material of Oscar Zeta Acosta, the inspiration for Dr. Gonzo, collection of original artwork by illustrator Ralph Steadman, excerpt from the 1996 Fear and Loathing audio CD with Murray Chaykin, Jim Jarmusch, and Harry Dean Stanton, and Fear and Loathing on the Road to Hollywood, a 1978 BBC documentary with Thompson and Steadman, and the usual booklet and essays Criterion usually do.
This is an awesome edition.
It's loaded, this one, yeah.
This is the best edition of this film.
Yeah. Well, like, Criterion loves Terry Gilliam, and Terry Gilliam loves Criterion, so it was just like, here's everything we got. It's pretty great. Yeah. But I guess that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode. If you have any comments or queries, think we missed anything like that, feel free to send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Criterion Quest, or on Facebook through The Criterion Quest. But other than that, we'll be back in a fortnight's time with another double episode, actually, when we do The Killers, 2 different versions of this the same story.
What, have I seen that before?
No, I think you might be thinking of The Killing, which is the Stanley Kubrick heist movie. Right. But,
so what's these ones?
I think it's they're 2 films, one made in 1946 and the other in 1964. So yeah, it's an adaptation of an Ernest Hemingway short story.
Okay.
So the first one, 1946, done by Robert Sayomark, and 1964 by Don Siegel, who is a pretty great guy. He did a lot of films with Clint Eastwood, like the original Dirty Harry and stuff.
Sweet.
Cool filmmaker. And great movie called Charlie Varick with Walter Matthau. Yeah.
All right. I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, should be interesting. But so tune in for that. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.